Agile for Humans is brought to you by Audible.com. Get one free audiobook and a 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/agile. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player, including Scrum, The Art of Doing Twice the Work in Half the Time by Jeff Sutherland, and Crucial Conversations by Carrie Patterson. Visit www.audibletrial.com/agile to enjoy your free audiobook today.
Processes and tools dominate today's Agile discussions, but we are devoted to the individuals and interactions that make it work. From the beginner to the veteran practitioner, we have something for you. Welcome to Agile for Humans.
All right, and welcome to this week's episode of Agile for Humans. I'm your host, Ryan Ripley. Joining me tonight, refreshed, recharged, rejuvenated, Zach Boniker. Zach, how you doing?
I'm good. I'm feeling recharged and rejuvenated.
Good adjectives tonight, right? Also joining us tonight, Dan Greening. Dan, how are you tonight?
Well, I'm jet-lagged because I just returned from the Philippines, and I'm exhausted, and so I'm the converse of Zach.
Dan is not refreshed.
Very good. Zach and I get in the no estimates discussion every once in a while.
Well, I hang out with I have some semi-agnostic friends. You know, of course, they're in the Kanban camp, and they are semi-no estimates people. But when you push them to the wall, they say, well, you can count the number of items you complete, and you can use that for forecasting. And then I say things like, but then you have to have this ginormous backlog in order to represent your long-term future. And they go, yeah, and then they change the subject.
That sounds about right.
We like to get in those conversations, you know, when we start talking about what do we do, why do we do it, what options do we have, what works, what doesn't, you know, what would be better. Like, to be honest, it's pretty just harmless in, wow, what might happen if this were the case, you know? And there's a few individuals that concept touches on their very livelihood, and they depend their professional cost estimators and their know-it-alls, and it just turns into this really just terrible conversation. Like, I don't even know how else to describe it. It actually drains my soul to the point where my Twitter block feed consists of just one individual.
It's almost just a continual state of disbelief that an adult, and this is someone who's a CXO level person, legitimately, who's behaving like this. And I love the idea of looking at estimation and thinking, do we really need to do Monte Carlo simulation?
Right.
Do we really need to go to the nth level of precision and the nth level of depth into each and every feature and topic of a project and come up with this nonsensical number? Because we have accidental complication, you know, the complication that occurs when people are just not good at their job. And we have essential complication for all the natural crazy things that are going to happen regardless of every risk remediation process and plan that you put in place. And we're supposed to pretend that we're giving some kind of document or number that people should be making multi-million dollar decisions on, and we're going to say that's good. And so I question that.
Yeah, you know, all do, right?
I just want to see, can we take a swag at it, get a little bit of work done, create a new forecast off of the actual, and then start building off of that. And that seems to be blasphemy to a very small subset of people.
Well, my big argument is that if you don't have people do that kind of estimation, people don't really think about architectures. They don't think about the complexity or what are the real issues and what are the risks and all that stuff. And yeah, I know that, you know, those risks are there, like you said, that they're going to get in your way and they're going to surprise you. And half of the things that you estimate are going to be completely wrong. But the fact that you estimated them means that you've done at least a minimal amount of architectural decision making or thinking. said, hey, so I want to see a backlog with a forecast horizon that's somewhere between 2 months and 6 months long. And that is like severe blasphemy, right? That's saying, and when you first confront people with that, they say, well, so you mean I have to have 200 estimated backlog items in my backlog? And I'm going, no, actually, I don't want that. I want you to have a maximum of like 40 backlog items or 50 backlog items that represent 2 to 6 months worth of work. And they go, how can we do that? And I'm going, well, you know, you need to estimate about a sprint or two sprints worth of little backlog items that are going to go into your sprint. And then the next 1 to 2 sort of sprints worth, like 14 items, they should be 10 times as big. And then they go, they like some kind of cork blows up in their brain, right? Like, oh no, that means I'll have to spend a week estimating every one. And I'm going, no, I want you to spend less than a half an hour estimating every one. It's crazy. But when you have that sort of big, chunky estimate stuff, what people think about is, what are the big, chunky risks they have to worry about? And then they start doing architecture in their head. You can see it happening. I just sort of love watching it. You know, people are going like, oh, you're saying we have to accommodate 1 million hits an hour. Oh my God, how do we do that? You know, like, and then they think about it and they go, oh, okay, I guess that would take about 3 weeks or 4 weeks or 200 points or whatever it is.
Yeah, so the no estimates, you know, mindset is going to say, you're right. Look at that value in that conversation. How can we build that value into just what we do as a, you know, a work system without having to explicitly do like an estimation event to get that value? Is there a way?
What might okay, happen? Good. You figure it out and call me.
The ironic part is that I'm a huge fan of planning poker. I love the concept as far as getting people into the mindset of fast estimation where the conversation is more important than the number.
Yeah.
And so I think it's wonderful. And if people progress down that lean path and they do, I really think Neil Killick's slicing heuristic is interesting. Mm. And so getting a story sliced down to a one and getting a team very good at being able to break their work down into 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, all of a sudden, you know, lean thinking kicks in. You're really just looking at throughput.
Right.
And I think that's fascinating. But in my opinion, it's advanced.
Yeah.
It's not a new team thing. So I think you start with the planning poker, you progress to, all right, we now know after years and years of working together as this single team with very low variance and turnover, you know, we understand how we work, we understand our domain, now we understand what a one looks like, now we can start looking at throughput.
Right.
But it's not a day one activity.
Right, and I would support that too, even in this sort of fractal model that I'm describing. But basically, you do that at the last stage when you're pulling stuff into the sprint. And
yes.
And I still want big, gigantic estimates for these other things, because otherwise you have hundreds of items in your backlog. And when you have hundreds of items in your backlog, think about the cognitive burden that you put on the product owner making decisions between which micro item should go in front of which other micro item, right? Like, no one's going to do that with 200 items. They're
justify
not going to
justify why 56 is higher priority than 57.
Right. I mean, that's just not possible. What they really need is they need to make decisions between like 10 different things. Like, is it more important to have 1 million hits in an hour, or is it more important to have 5 nines reliability? You know, like, someone has to tell us this.
Yeah, and it's the non-functionals, like what you're talking about, that's an intelligent argument, right? So that's something that we really should talk through and decide, how are non-functionals handled in a no-estimate situation? And I think that's an important discussion. Mm. I agree with the epics. I love having epics on a backlog. The PO cannot figure out everything up front.
No.
Just as development teams cannot estimate everything up front with any kind of accuracy. So you have to have these big nebulous ideas that are decomposed into these smaller chunks and smaller chunks. And, you know, 5 or 6 conversations later, you have this smaller story and we all understand what we're doing. We got the card, the conversation, and the confirmation, right, from the old story card format, the Ron Jeffries, the 3 C's, right? And then once we're there, we go. And I think it's a beautiful model. And if we could just get everyone to that point, I think the no estimates conversation would go away.
Yeah. You know,
if everyone's working like that, there's no reason to start fighting against estimates anymore, because that would be a wonderful way to do work.
Right. It's like a sideshow sort of, right? I mean, I think one of the things that's really frustrating to me is that I think the no estimates crowd is getting power from the fact that people are abusing the agile term. They're not really agile. They're like getting into these slog meetings that last for hours and hours, where they're taking an hour to estimate a dinky story, right? We haven't seen teams spontaneously, you know, do low cost estimation. So basically, we're just going to get rid of estimation completely. And that's kind of sad. But I think we should, you know, like Zach says, you know, we should cure the agile cancer, not kill the patient.
Well, and I think that's also an interesting discussion. It's an area that I think has needed a lot of work. It's an area that Zach and I have talked about before previously on the podcast. It's really the patterns that companies demonstrate as they become agile. And I'm curious if you could start with just a high-level overview, and then perhaps we'll walk through and talk through these 5 important base patterns.
Okay, so the general idea is that there's a lot of people who have been asking, are we agile? And then people, you know, give them some kind of arbitrary list of, you know, things that they should be doing that are agile. And then some people that say that Kanban is agile, and some people say that no, that's not true, Kanban is lean, and all sorts of other crazy stuff. And I got kind of frustrated with it, because I think they're all in the same pile. So I think lean, Kanban, agile in general, and Scrum and lean startup and XP and all that stuff are really trying to solve basically the same problem. So the problem is this, that we are doing creative things that we've never done before, in environments where the economy that we're operating in is changing rapidly. And it's changing in ways that we can't predict with any certainty over the long term. Over the short term, we can kind of predict it. So those kinds of economies, I guess, are what are called chaotic economies. Things are chaotic if you can predict roughly what's happening in the short term, but as time goes on, it gets less and less predictable. And so at some point in the future, you're not able to predict. And so if you try to plan a project that's long term, like let's say 12 months or 6 months, you could be totally wrong. And then you could spend lots and lots of time building this thing and lots of money, and then you unleash it on the world and you discover, oops, you know, the world has moved on, or our conception of the world was totally wrong. So all of those techniques, lean startup, XP, Scrum, and even Pomodoro and getting things done, all have this idea that you want short-term activities, and then you test them against your environment, and then you adapt to what you see, and you just keep going all the time. So I took all of those methodologies and I broke them down into their constituent parts. And then I clustered those constituent parts together to try to find what are the common elements of these things. And there were 5 patterns, as we talked about. And they're very simple, actually, it turns out. But the simplicity actually creates a challenge, because once you start articulating them, people go, oh, we don't do that. And we call ourselves Agile, or we're using Scrum, but we don't actually do that. So here they are in a nutshell. First, Agile practices have to measure economic progress. And by that, I mean leading indicators for what kind of goal you're trying to go for. So a leading indicator for Scrum is our velocity going up? Basically, are we producing? And then it turns out if you just measure that, that's pretty perverse. You end up generating lots of code really fast, and then you generate really buggy code. So most teams that start with velocity then ultimately realize they have to measure released bug count or bug fix time or other things related to quality. And then what we have now started to see a trend in the Scrum world is to add a third metric called happiness. So now you're measuring the speed they're producing stuff, you're measuring the quality of the code that you're producing, and then happiness is the team's happiness with the process that it uses. And that's, I think, a surrogate for a leading indicator, as I like to say, for communication within the team. So all these things are leading indicators because they're really cheap to measure, and you can measure them on recent activity. So that's Scrum, right? Like, it measures that stuff. And if you think about all those metrics that I provided, they're all about cost metrics. So how much does it cost to build a predefined set of software that's embedded in a backlog? So higher velocity decreases the cost. That's cool. And lower bug count decreases the long-term cost. That's cool. And better communication through greater team happiness decreases the cost. That's really awesome too. And so that's kind of interesting about Scrum. So if we think about the metrics that are embedded in Scrum, Scrum is a production optimization system. So its economy is all about cost and production cost. But then if we look at the other side, on the value side, Scrum doesn't really tell us how that's done. And so on that side, we have Lean Startup, and now we're starting to measure things that have value. We're saying, you know, what is the customer engagement? What is the net promoter score? What is the click-through rate? What is, you know, all these things that we measure on the value side. And it's interesting that Lean Startup virtually ignores the cost of developing software. So those two work together really well, Lean Startup and Scrum, or XP, which has a lot of equivalencies to Scrum, or Kanban, which is basically Scrum without a rhythm. And so that's that one pattern. Are you measuring economic progress? So our discussion that we started out with was all about the no estimates crowd, and basically they're hobbling one of our metrics. They're saying we don't want estimates because, you know, they're too hard to do. We just want to be let alone to do our thing. And I guess I'm okay with that as long as we're measuring something that is related to production rate, because that will help us fuel the other patterns that I'm about to talk about, like the next one. So the second pattern is, are you proactively experimenting to improve? So the idea here is that are you in Scrum, it's in a retrospective. You're saying, or in a retrospective, you should be saying, well, how did we do last time, last sprint? What were our metrics? Did we have a hypothesized result from, you know, whatever process changes we were going to make? And then how did the hypothesis match up with the actual result? Was it a surprise? And what things were surprising? And what do we think the causes of those surprises were? So it could be that your velocity went way up because you added something cool to your ready criteria, like you know, we will not accept something into the sprint that has dependencies, or, you know, something like that will often radically change the production rate. So, and proactive experimentation puts a big burden on people who say they're agile, but phone in their retrospectives. So, you know, like all of us have seen retrospectives where people, you know, stand around and say, well, it went badly, and what are we going to do next time? And they go like, well, it went pretty well, and, you know, the people yelled at me, and, you know, I don't think we should change anything because it seems to be going okay.
Yeah, right, so they almost seem to either want to continue the status quo and just be very quiet about it, or who observe and see the dysfunction, but they're just uncomfortable trying to address it directly.
Sure, right, exactly. There can be many reasons that they do it. One is personal, like I just don't want to be bothered and I just want to come into work and do my thing, and then I have another life outside and I don't want to have to think too hard. But then there's the other one, like you said, where there's enormous pressures from above, and experimentation actually creates danger for people because some of their experiments are going to work and some of them are not going to work. And so they have to start getting good at risk assessment, and they need to run experiments that aren't too risky but actually produce, you know, interesting results that help them improve over time. And, you know, those things are hard, so people just don't want to do them. So that's the second pattern. And, you know, by the time you get to the second pattern, 80% of the people who claim they're doing Agile aren't doing it. It's kind of sad, right? So, but okay, so having a good retrospective gets you into the, you know, blessed camp of you got the second pattern right, and having some kind of metric like quality and production rate if you're doing Scrum or on start the other stuff is it gets you into that groove that, okay, you've got two of the patterns that you need to have agility. And then the third pattern clinches the deal. It says, okay, now you really are agile if you're doing this, and that is, do you limit work in process? So Scrum tries to limit work in process by saying you must release every sprint, or, you know, Jeff has said you must have a releasable increment. What I mean by Jeff is Jeff Sutherland, the guy who invented Scrum. He says, you know, you have to have a releasable increment at the end of every sprint. Jeff did this little tour of Silicon Valley recently, and he asked every team, like, are you able to release what you did to the consumer of your product, which might be another team, at the end of your sprint? And 80% of the teams that he talked to said they did not, that they were on some other schedule. And actually, if you look at SAFe has this idea of a release cadence, which is some fixed number of sprints. And so what usually happens when you have that is that people load all sorts of crazy stuff in the last sprint, like testing or, you know, localization or something really important for the software. So what that really means is if you've got four sprints in a release cadence, then your release cadence is your true sprint. It's the only thing you can really measure production rate on, because you actually are finally doing the act of producing the thing at the end. And so this is, I don't think this is as much of a challenge as the second one, but it's a challenge for many. And once you start articulating that, people go, oh, yeah, okay. And I remember going to teams and saying, you know, what's your sprint length? And a bunch of teams and one big company said, you know, our sprint length is 2 weeks because the boss said the two-week sprint is the ideal sprint to have. And I'm going, okay, cool. So I guess you're able to ship every 2 weeks. And they go, well, no, you know, like, and I go, okay, so tell me all about that. And they go, yeah, we do 2 weeks of development, we do 2 weeks of development, we do 2 weeks of development. And then we take our developers and we have them work on a branch. And then we have our testers and our localization team work in the last sprint and finalize the deal. And I'm going, okay, so let me take a wild guess that that last sprint, sometimes it doesn't take 8 weeks to get to that point. You get to the fourth sprint and then you go, oh, there's some bugs and we got to fix something serious, and it might take another 2 weeks, and then maybe it's 10 weeks or maybe even 12 weeks. And they go, hey, how did you know that? You know? But it's sort of obvious on the face of it, right? Like, if you can't actually test in a sprint, and then you're deferring a lot of risk, and then you don't know what that risk is because, you know, we're dealing with a chaotic economy, and so it's just kind of crazy. Anyway, so that's the third. So when I had that conversation with people, then I would say, they would say, well, what do you want me to do? What do you want us to do? And I said, well, what I want you to do is tell the truth. So telling the truth means to tell people openly that you have an 8-week sprint, and then actually think of it as an 8-week sprint, and then think of that as a dysfunction or a thing to fix, an impediment to your agility, and see if you can get it down to 6 weeks. You know, and they go, really? And they say, won't the, you know, VP, you know, look weird at us and the metrics will look bad? And I'm going, like, I've talked to the VP and he understands this problem, and no. But having the honesty means that you'll improve over time. And there were teams that did that, and they became much more successful, actually. And they were the people that in this company that pioneered the idea of counting external bug count and other really interesting things. So the
question of, won't that make our metrics look bad? That to me is one of the scariest questions that a Scrum Master faces.
Yeah. And it requires a lot of education, right? Like it. So I've written about this, that top down agile beats bottom up. By that I mean that having agile leaders who actually believe in measuring themselves and their entire departments using these mechanisms will improve that a lot, right? Because they're going to start measuring stuff, and they're going to ideally be experimenting, and they're going to have little failures too. And they're going to start realizing that metrics, you know, they're really important to have, but they also are most valuable if we don't put too much weight on them in terms of people's careers. What we're looking for is, we're actually looking in experimentation for a failure rate of about 50%. For low-cost experiments, that should be the rate, because around there is where you learn the most. What happens is if you have 100% success all the time, you don't know whether the failure point is really close, but you're just missing it every time, or you're missing failure by a mile, right? And the same on the other side. If you miss your proposed velocity 100% of the time because you're trying to be overly aggressive about it, you might not even be close at all, you know, and or you might be super close, and if you just like squeak down a little bit, you'd start getting a little bit of success, and you can see what changes you're making in processes that are improving your results. So I often tell people, if I see 100% success or 100% failure in a team, that means to me that needs to be fixed first.
Yeah, it almost feels like those type of outcomes are kind of what we talked about just a second ago, about really just letting the status quo be, or making excuses for that dysfunction. I mean, 100%, you know, success ratio kind of just feels like you're watering down things to the point where you're just kind of letting the status quo slowly hang on. And a 0% failure rate with your experiments just means, again, you're not really addressing it. You know, you're really kind of just making excuses for it. You're not trying to actually get in there and potentially solve it.
Yeah.
I wanted to say too, there was, Again, I know after having, you know, talked and worked with you, I know you've got 5 base patterns, and it's been really, really awesome to get such an in-depth discussion on them. But I want to say, you said something a second ago about the honesty of an 8-week sprint, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so again, not making excuses for the status quo, not ignoring the dysfunction, calling it an 8-week sprint. But you were talking about the traditional Scrum model of, hey, 2 weeks. And this is what the company was doing, was saying, hey, 2 weeks, 2 weeks, 2 weeks.
Yeah.
I really thought it was worth pointing out that this has been a big topic for me lately in my transition with companies, is instead of asking them and saying, cool, you're doing an 8-week sprint now, what can we do now to get to that ideal state of 2 weeks? Is you looked at what the smallest increment towards that could be, and you said, let's try 6. Let's get good at that first.
Yeah, yeah.
And then let's try to improve. And to me, that's such a wonderful thing to hear, right? Because I think there's so much attention on what, you know, like the Scrum framework and the Scaled Agile framework, big picture, and all these ideal states. And I feel like so many of our organizations are just so far from being able to sustain that to give them the ability to say, let's take steps toward it, and focusing instead on the transition, it's just wonderful to hear. And I heard that, and I just went, that was great. 6 weeks. Yeah. Can you do 6 weeks? And that's a huge win, instead of just trying to get them to do 2 weeks. I loved hearing that.
So one of the funny things is that I have concluded, you know, there is a cost to having a short sprint cycle, that because you have to repeatedly do something. And so, for example, I did this on a napkin with some buddies at Agile 2015, where I'm going, okay, so let's look at the testing cost when we move to Agile for an 18 project, and let's just presume that everything goes perfectly in this 18-month project. So regression testing happens in this last phase of this 18-month project. And you only have to do it once because everybody's perfect, right? So that testing cost is, let's call it X. You know, like 3 testers for 18 months worth of testing. Okay, so $300,000, let's say. Mm-hmm. So then let's go to Agile with just 1 month sprints. And let's compute how much regression testing has to be done over this time period. So when you think about the first sprint, well, testing is really easy. It's 1/18th of the functionality that you would normally have. And so you have 1/18th X of work there. But then the second sprint is 2/18ths, and the third is 3/18ths, and the fourth is 4/18ths. And pretty soon you've got, you know, and the reason for that is because you're accumulating functionality over time, and you have to test all of the previous functionality you did in previous sprints as well as the current one. So if you take all of that and you add all of that testing work up, you get 9 times X. So in other words, 9 times X is 27 testers. So we've increased the cost of testing from $300,000 to $2.7 million if you stick with manual testing, right? And I think people – so what? I'm going to get back to our previous conversation. But what's interesting about that is that actually explains a lot of Agile's so-called dysfunctions. You know, some people say Agile produces crappy code, you know, like it's really buggy. And I think that's an artifact of these people ignoring the accumulating cost of testing, having a bunch of manual testers and being super lazy about it and not even realizing that it's, you know, this coming train wreck. So what they do is they have 3 testers, and then all the developers do just development. And then they got about a quarter of the way in, and now the testers are working, you know, pretty full time to do all this testing every sprint. And then they run out of steam. And then no one has realized that they need to automate yet. And so they're out of steam and they can't test everything. And the team continues to ship because we tell them they should ship. And then they start producing crappy code, and people go, what's wrong? And they go, well, we're Agile. and and they're producing crap. And so, of course, they have to automate because what is happening is, I guess this is illustrating the point I was trying to make, that Agile has a cost. And that cost is that you have to repeatedly do things that you only had to do once before. And so there's a limit to that cost. We can't go to one-day sprints always. Sometimes we can, but it depends on the work. And so I like what you said, Zach. I think it's true that we have to start where we are, you know, and we have to gradually get better. And we may find that in certain circumstances, we can't go any lower than a certain thing because of the type of work we're doing. So,
or until we address it, right? Until we can almost look at that as exposing some, it may not feel like dysfunction, but if you think about it from a technical excellence standpoint, that's fairly dysfunctional. Well, it is. And so we start to address it.
Yeah. I think it is when we're talking about web. But when we're talking about hardware, maybe not.
Yeah.
So, one of the purposes of these Agile base patterns is to move away from the Agile manifesto for software development as a definition for Agile. So, you know, I looked at that thing and, you know, we've all tried to sort of beat this horse. Like we go to the CEO and we say, hey, the whole company should be Agile. And the CEO goes, well, what's that? And then we hand him or her the Agile manifesto for software development. And it talks about shipping working code to customers, right? And so, okay, you know, they don't even know what that means, right? And how it applies to them.
Sure.
So I think defining Agile in a more generic way actually improves the ability to communicate that. So, but in any event, I do think that Agile has a benefit, right? Like the benefit is that we are able to surf chaos better, and therefore we can beat the crap out of our competitors if we're doing a better job of Agile than they are. But there's a cost to that, and I like it when we tell people the truth about that. Because I think if they know there's a cost, they can prepare for that. So they cannot be hiding their head under the, you know, sand about testing, manual testing costs. They can say, well, if we're going to do Agile, we really have to address the manual testing stuff right up front. Like, we're going to start this project and sure, testing should be easy, but we got to handle that right now. And other things that relate to releasing a product, like localization. If you're actually shipping something that's localized to 100 different languages every 2 weeks, that's kind of hard using traditional translation mechanisms. So you have to think of something and some creative things to do.
Yeah,
well, I think the other important point there is that being agile isn't the goal, right? And I think that gets lost in a lot of conversations. You hand the manifesto to the CEO and you say, we got to be agile. We're going to be agile. This is how we're going to check the box and be agile. And really, we're just trying to optimize organizations and optimize delivery. And so
for the economies that they're operating in, and some of them are slow.
Absolutely. And some companies, a 5 or 6 week sprint maybe the most responsible way to stay in alignment with HR, marketing, all these other departments, and it's the most cost-effective way for that domain or that organization to actually deliver software, which makes Agile a success because it discovered that limitation.
Yeah, and yeah. I love it.
Realizing that that's the goal, I think, is incredibly important and often gets lost.
You know, I want to challenge that a little bit, though, right? Because let me look at it from this perspective. If we're talking about Agile, for, you know, as a software development, you know, the Agile manifesto for software development, that clearly is the goal, is to be releasing to customers, you know, as short a time frame as possible. Sure, you get market cadence that you have to support. If I'm a big financial, you know, software provider, I get it. My clients, they're going to regression test the heck out of their multi-billion dollar, you know, of assets that they're holding. I understand that. They only want two releases a year, sure. But being able to get my software to a state where if they could take it, I could ship it to them is kind of that ideal state. So it's almost that from an internal perspective, we can develop it beyond, beyond what the market cadence is. We could just be in the state where we could ship it to them. So, I mean, it's pretty clear in that goal by saying, hey, you know, maybe six is about as good as B at that time because of market cadence, I would say is almost a little bit too soft, or at least what that ideal state of the manifesto for agile software development.
Well, but this I would is push
what
back
is really really radical about what's really radical about what Dan's doing here is if you've noticed in all three of the patterns that we've discussed so far, there's never anything. I mean, the word software, you know, development doesn't occur anywhere. I mean, so. Perhaps maybe saying, okay, whatever we're doing, we could run on 6-week cycles or less or more or whatever. It doesn't really matter. It really speaks to, you know, what the organization does and how it operates rather than the specifics of the Agile software manifesto, which is exactly the problem that, you know, Dan brought up. You take that to the CEO and they go, well, this is a developer's thing. And what Dan is creating is the environment for us to speak to potentially anybody in any organization. And I think that's, I don't know, for me, that's pretty big on my mind. It kind of opens it up a lot.
I think I would push back on one area. And in the manifesto, it's very clear that agile processes promote sustainable development. The sponsors, developers, and users should be able to maintain a constant pace indefinitely. Yeah. And that constant pace is going to be different. And it even goes on. There's a few more principles that I think help this discussion. You know, deliver working software frequently from a couple of weeks to a couple of months with a preference to the shorter time scale. So I agree they want shorter, but overall, sustainable pace, a short enough time scale, but our highest priority is to satisfy the customer through early and continuous delivery of valuable software. So we have three working factors here, right? First of all, we have to be sustainable. Secondly, we are delivering within a couple of weeks to a couple of months. And finally, it's delighting the customer or satisfying the customer. And if we hit those in a six-week sprint, can we still be successful? And I would argue yes.
Yeah, it's interesting. I like what Zach said, but more that it's an interesting thought experiment.
Right.
It's almost turning theory of constraints a little bit on its head. That now it's not really a pull model. It's sort of like the pull isn't totally there. So what you're actually doing is you're creating this inventory of code that's just ready for the customer whenever they're actually ready to pull, right? Like so, so it's still a constraint. It's that the customer is the constraint. The customer is not able to consume the stuff as fast as we're able to deliver it to them. And so I do think that it's interesting because I have been thinking about systemic problems, which I think are both, you know, before we started having this conversation, I was thinking they were totally, like if you're looking at a team, the constraint, there's a constraint on the agility of the team based on who they depend on. So if they depend on other teams and the teams, you know, have an 8-week sprint, but this little team that is, you know, has a 2-week sprint, it doesn't really matter in a way because, you know, there's a lot of stuff that takes 8 weeks to change to get to this little team. And so they have, in order to improve their own agility, they have to reach out beyond the boundary of that little team and educate people they depend on to start being more agile. Sort of like Toyota, you know, like when it famously had this just-in-time model throughout the plants, and so basically a customer would make an order, and they would say, "Oh, a customer made an order. We got to get going, and we got to build the chassis, and build the body, and build the wheels, and build the tires." And then someone says, "Hey, wait a minute. We don't build tires. We order them from a tire manufacturer, and then you know, people say, okay, well, we better go order the four tires we need for this car. And they go to the tire manufacturer and say, hey, we need four tires. And the tire manufacturer says, you know, are you crazy? We, you know, you have to give us 90 days advance warning about how many tires you want. How many tires do you want over the next 90 days? And Toyota says, well, we don't know. We're just in time. So, so that required Toyota to go out and say, okay, we're agile, but our tire manufacturers are not, and they're going to inhibit our own agility, and so we have to teach them how to be just in time as well. So on the other side, here we have Zach asserting that, you know, and in a way he's right, right? Like, we've got the customer, they're the final puller of the stuff. But from the end customer, like the people who are really using this stuff, they are not getting the agile benefits exactly, right? Like, there's this big impediment, and that's, you know, we, the software developers who are serving this bigger organization, that's this kind of this behemoth. Anyway, well, it's interesting.
Well, I favor Zach's thinking. I'd rather crush the impediment and go to that pull model. I'm okay with a backlog of increments of software that the business can pull at will. But also trying to think holistically, what does that do to the business side? And what does that do to cost? And I just think it's an interesting, like you said, thought exercise. I don't think either one of us are necessarily wrong. It's just which philosophy is going to fly with the decision makers and with the teams and what's going to make most sense. And I actually think both models can work very well. And it really plays into your fourth pattern, actually, which is embrace collective responsibility. You know, once they make that decision about what kind of environment or organization they're going to be, they really have to bond around that and really make that decision and go.
Yeah, so we should talk about that, I guess. So so I talked about these three patterns, like you're measuring leading indicators for your economy, you're proactively experimenting for improvement, and then you're limiting work in progress. And if you have those three, I have asserted that you are agile. You know, that the deed is done. If you can actually keep that up, more power to you. But in fact, what we've all seen is that agility is not sustainable unless we add some more stuff. And so one of the things that we have to add is this collective responsibility idea, which is you join a team, and by joining a team, you agree that I agree that I will be personally responsible for the collective output of this team. And that state of responsibility is a pretty tall order for most people. It means that if you say that, it means you can't really blame other people for the fact that you weren't able to ship your software at the end of the sprint. You can't blame the testers if you're a developer, and you can't blame the stupid HR department that doesn't let you hire more testers, and you can't blame the stupid organization that is constantly pressuring you to put out software even though it's not, you know, it's filled with bugs. Now you are taking personal responsibility, and so what that means is you have to fix it when these challenges appear. These are impediments that you have to approach. And so having that sense of collective responsibility kind of creates a, I think, an agile machine in a way, right? Like, now people are willing to adapt because otherwise they're going to be responsible for a failure. So, you know, we discover that there's too much testing load in the team, and engineers, developers say, oh, well, maybe I can help with that. Or, you know, we lose a database person and someone says, well, you know, we're going to fail to ship unless we do something. And then they either hire immediately another database person, or they learn enough database to actually do the job, or they try to drag the, you know, whatever it is they're going to try to do to make that team successful. And so that creates this, I think, really holistic idea within the team that makes it more sustainable, that agility is more likely to stay in the context of a changing workload. So
this actually goes, though, I mean, when we talk about collective responsibility, it could be beyond the team. It could be a manager thing. It kind of feels like the first thing I do when things don't go my way is I check where I am in the work system.
Right.
You know, I ask upstream first, is there anything that we did that could have contributed to this or that we could change or affect, and then work your way down, right? Rather than what it feels like most organizations do is say, oh, that launch didn't go well. Well, what the heck, team or tester or whatever, right?
Who should I fire?
Yeah, it's that. What's that old thing they used to call in the Scrum world for a product owner, the single wringable neck, you know, right? That doesn't seem to support the idea of collective responsibility.
Yeah,
so, where's my throat to choke?
Yeah, no. I've stopped. I will admit that I used to use that phrase, but I have stopped using that phrase because I agree with you. You know, if your product owner is not doing their job, then other people can fill in for that, or you need to hire another one or something. But the only way to do that is for people on the team to feel personally responsible for having a good product owner. Yeah. And I've seen teams that actually did do that. You know, that they helped educate their product owners, and the product owners became much better. So anyway, that's the fourth pattern, that collective responsibility idea. And the fifth pattern...
Hey, Dan, can I ask one more question on that?
Yeah.
In your mind, so collective responsibility, this is, for me, clearly a cultural thing, less like measuring economic progress and adaptively. For me, this is culture. Right.
Okay. Yeah.
So could this go all the way to say, I mean, is there a limit to where this should stop? Or is this, I mean, even a CEO of an organization feels, you know, responsible?
Absolutely. I think the CEO should feel responsible. And I think the biggest problems that we have with collective responsibility are not necessarily at the team level. I mean, when you're looking at big organizations, you know, one of the things that happens in these big organizations is most people are operating at the level of the team, and they just assume that the geniuses at the VP level are, you know, they don't even, it's almost a mystery, like how did those people get those jobs? And, you know, and even at the top, people are wondering how they got the job, right? but what happens is the role differentiation at the VP level is really extreme, and yet there are these really important things that VPs should be collaborating on, and they often don't. So HR related things are really, every VP should be very interested in. You know, what are the job descriptions? What is the promotion structure? How do we do performance reviews? How do we do all that stuff? They should be totally into that stuff, and they should be working very hard to improve teaching, coaching, mentoring in the organizations. And by far, most VPs, that is the furthest thing from their mind. They're spending most of their time doing tactical stuff because the CEO came in and barked about something, and then they all jump and try to address it, or they assign it to someone, or they blame someone else, right? So they definitely could benefit from this collective responsibility idea that, yes, I am the VP of finance, and the engineering department ships late all the time. What can I do to help that situation? Yep. Right, that's a kind of a challenge, right? But I think that, you know, the beyond budgeting people are telling us that there's plenty of stuff that the finance department can do to help with engineering producing late software. So it's very interesting. I just think that what I love about these patterns, I'm really happy about the outcome, but it just feels so good to me because I feel like I can go to a VP and I can just, you know, run through these patterns and figure out how agile they are. And so we did talk about the fourth pattern, and I want to talk about the fifth one. Then I want to talk about a project I'm doing with Scrum Inc., which I think is really interesting. So the fifth pattern is this idea of solving systemic problems. So, yeah, you can do the three basic agile patterns, and now you're agile, and then you can have collective responsibility, and now with that, you actually have this resilient agility within your team that, you know, you can deal with whatever onslaught the world is going to, you know, strike you with. And then now we get hung up with this idea that we depend on these other teams or we depend on outside suppliers for things, and they're not agile or they have constraints on their ability to deliver that is impeding our own agility. And so in order to solve those problems, you really have to reach out. You have to be a diplomat, essentially. So the team has to start saying, hey, you know what, we depend on these other teams and they ship us buggy code every time, and now we're avoiding taking their software, and instead we're, you know, building on old software. Well, that's very unagile, right? Like, we're not, as a system, we're not able to ship recent infrastructure code in our system because we're so afraid that this software they're delivering us is buggy. So we should be reaching out and helping them, but then you find territorialism, you find, you know, not invented here. All sorts of challenges face us when we start trying to mentor, coach, and train other teams that we're depending on. And yet, this challenge is one that's required to maintain agility when you're in a bigger system than a single team. And so this is the one that we break our teeth on a lot. You know, like, there's definitely one or two, you know, fired people along the roadkill highway, right, that have tried to deal with this. How do we interact with other people diplomatically, and how do we bring them into our agile tent without alienating them and all that stuff? And so that's a hard one, and I'm starting to write about it, and I think I have to write about it with not all the answers, because I'm not sure that we have all the answers yet. But there are certain patterns, sub-patterns in that solving systemic problems that we're all familiar with. So one of them is theory of constraints. So the theory of constraints is this idea that your system is composed of a series of dependencies that actually finally deliver something to the customer. And some of those dependencies are really fast and some of them are ridiculously slow. But because those dependencies are buried inside the system, we don't even know that that's the thing that's impeding our speed. And so we generate all sorts of inventory of code, or if you're a manufacturing plant, lots of inventory of shelved parts and stuff like that. And at the end, the only way we know something's wrong is that the customer ordered something and it takes them months and months and months to get it. And yet, if you actually looked at the production line, it shouldn't, if we didn't have any of this crap sitting in there, it should take just a few weeks to get to the customer. And so when you do that, you start you analyze the whole system. You look at what are all the dependencies, what's their actual throughput, who are the people that are most constrained, who are the teams that are most constrained, and then you do this radical, weird thing. You say, okay, we're going to take that slowest team and we're going to slow every other team down in this production chain to the speed of that team. And that, you know, people lose their minds over that, right? Like, they go, you've got to be kidding. That's not efficient. We're not keeping people busy all the time. And so, and yet, what's happened when you do that is it's pretty quick that you reveal, okay, this is the slowest team. And look, we've got all these extra resources that we have freed up because we've slowed all these teams down. Why don't we put some of those resources on this super slow team and speed it up a little bit? And so they speed it up, and guess what? The whole system starts going faster. And then it becomes not the impediment anymore, not the constraint. And then other teams become the constraint, and you just do the same thing all over again. So this is thinking about the teams as a sequence that are serving the customer. And we do something which is counterintuitive to us. We always think that, having all the resources busy is the most efficient way to produce something, but it's not. So that theory of constraints idea is one of those. There's five whys problem solving, where we look at all the reasons that problems occur, and then we look farther back at even more indirect reasons and more indirect reasons until we actually find kind of key dysfunctions in the organization that if we just fix those dysfunctions, that all these things would start going really fast. So in a sense, they're kind of they're dependencies, but they're all of these dependencies, they're sort of hidden. And only if we start thinking systemically can we really address them. And yet, when we think systemically, we create diplomatic challenges in virtually every case. And so that, to me, is, our biggest challenge in Agile is dealing with that, because people's careers are at stake. Their self-conception in the organization. How do they operate? And this is where we get resistance to Agile in mid-level managers, because, it starts exposing problems that they may have caused for decades that no one ever knew about. And now they have to rethink how they do things, or they're going to be lame and people are going to know. So those are the five patterns, right? Measure economic progress, proactively experiment to improve, measure, limit work in process, and then collective responsibility, and then finally this idea of solving systemic problems. So with those five, I think you get what I call expansive agility. So now having a team that has all five of these patterns, they're actually able to influence teams outside them and improve their agility as well, and they improve the whole organization as long as they're allowed to function that way. And that is our greatest challenge, is to protect those teams and those people that are actually doing that systemic problem solving, because their job is very difficult.
Hey, Dan, so I had a thought come into my head and thank you for giving us such a really articulate, in-depth look at these patterns and what drives them. It's easy, one, just to describe them, because they kind of make sense. But, really, when you get down to some of the real mechanics behind it, these are not these are complex patterns.
Yeah.
Without question. So something that kind of occurred to me would thinking about the idea of adaptively experimenting and maybe limiting some of your work in progress, looking at the idea of collective responsibility, shared accountability. There's been a real popular thing, as in the last couple of years, and I think in almost all of our podcasts we talk about it at some point somehow, about scaling and what that means. Yeah. And you've got this emergence of the scaled Agile framework and discipline Agile delivery, and all clearly meant to be benevolent, beneficial, to bring good thought, to help organizations. But it almost seems like a company that hasn't begun the Agile journey, then, that starts to go through and understand what this transformation means to them and what it looks like to them, and just jumps right to something like SAFe. That would almost be an Agile or an anti-pattern of the Agile organization, right? Because, think about how many of those patterns it breaks by going from, this is where we are today, and we're just going to radically reinvent the organization to be like the scaled Agile framework in a snap.
Yeah.
That breaks so many of the patterns, right? It's almost an anti-pattern, right? We're not experimenting. There's clearly no limit in work in progress there. We're trying to, eat the whole thing at once.
Right.
It just kind of occurred to me, maybe that's what, for me, has felt so, hard for me to accept and to get behind, some of these movements. I think maybe because I see some of that in the industry.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, and we all have had to solve agility from the bottom up for the most part, right? That Agile Manifesto was written for little teams, and then we applied it, and it started to work for these little startup teams. But then, we realized that we had bigger problems when we tried to deal with this in larger organizations. And, even today we have people say that Agile is just for little organizations. It doesn't make any sense for big organizations. And I think the issue for us is we are little cogs in this machine, and we see the world from the perspective of our little sphere. And so I think that's what SAFE did. It said, okay, I'm dealing with this non-agile entity, and I'm working down here at the bottom, so I need to... They are doing this expansive agility idea. They're expanding upward, and then they're creating these structures like the release train and all this stuff up above. But I think that, you know, it's maybe a hard discussion to have, and it will take a while, but it's so much easier, I think, to talk to a CEO or a CTO of a 1,000-person organization and go through and say, okay, here are the principles of agility, and we need to apply that to you. So you need to be shipping full-on projects with your hardware and software all combined and whatever, and you need not to do it at an 18-month cycle. We need you to get it down to 6, so that will limit your work in process. We need you to be experimenting with both the market and your production methods. You can't just sit on your butt all the time. And the goal is to get your agility better. So that 6 months should be dropping, and that's a metric to tell us, you know, whether you're improving. And then, you know, your quality should always be measured. It's almost all of the CMMI stuff, right? So if you can get the agile, if you can get the CTO or the CEO of that big organization to go, okay, I see how that works. I see how that benefits me in this crazy economy we're in. And I can see how it makes me a better innovator in that economy. And we could create a highly successful company. When they cross that threshold, I don't think it's hard at all to get the rest of the organization to follow through on Agile, because they need the organization to be Agile in order to realize those goals. And I think we have done ourselves a disservice by giving lip service to the executives here, because they are the fundamental limiter for agility in an organization. And they are the people that really chafe when we're challenging them, and they're going like, why are you challenging me? Agile is for engineers, you know, like, go away. And then we build these structures like SAFE that sort of preserve their non-agile world at the top of the organization, but create these Baroque, you know, kind of adapters to their waterfall world so that we can be agile underneath and kind of get less and less agile as we go up the organization.
Yeah, and that's what I think is really so powerful about this conversation and hearing you go into detail on these patterns. Because, you know, again, going back to the idea that I can sell this visual, this real picture, but I'm still talking about a software, an approach to developing software. And sure, my company may be a pure software development shop. But when we talk about the patterns, about what this organization is, who it wants to be, and again, there's the aspect of, for me personally, some of these things are cultural. You know, this is a much, much more powerful tool set to engage with those people that drive real organizational transformation, the top, you know, the presidents, the CEOs, you know, those people. We can talk to them about who they want to become and why it matters, and we can evoke change to allow the organization to become that dynamic or agile organization that fits, you know, them, the people that, rather than just try to give them a framework and hope that it eventually itself influences. It's almost this abstract version of a bottom-up transformation, isn't it? Where I come in and I say, cool, at your execution, at your development level, that's what the organization is going to look like. And hopefully that changes you up at the top, rather than using the patterns to engage change from the very top. And I think that's really powerful.
Mm. Well, and let me ask you this, Dan. If you have an organization or a culture that has embraced all 5 patterns, so let's say that they're continually doing adaptive experiments for improvement, they all embrace the idea of collective responsibility, they're limiting their work in process to ensure that they can do the right things, they measure that right thing, whatever that is, by looking at the economic progress, and they're solving systemic problems that get in the way of that progress, isn't scaling inherent to that?
Well, absolutely. I that's Yeah, exactly. That is exactly what I'm saying, is that if you do it at the top, it has to happen at the bottom. Basically, So, Zach, you said something that it's a little nuanced, and so I didn't know if I caught it correctly, but I think one of the things that when I say top-down Agile beats bottom-up, a lot of people think, oh, that means that the CEO is doing what they normally do, which is they say, oh, Agile is the fad of the month, and we have to do that because I read it in Harvard Business Review. And so they go to the engineering department and they go, like, how come we don't have 100 Scrum teams? And the CTO says, well, you didn't tell me we had to have 100 Scrum teams, and I now have to hire some trainers and stuff like that and do this conversion and whatever. And then they go, okay, well, go do that.
Isn't that just business as normal? That's the directive from the top to do something?
Yeah, but that isn't what maybe this is the problem with saying top-down Agile beats bottom-up. That's not actually what I mean by that. What I mean by that is that I think is it essentially a bottom-up implementation. So what I mean by top-down Agile beats bottom-up is I mean a top-down implementation. So the top says, we are going to be Agile first. And then what happens, I think, to Ryan's point, is that it kind of creates agility on its own in a way. I kind of think that if you had executives do this, and I've seen executives that did do this, they read or they worked with someone, like a coach or something like that, and at the executive level and said, we want an Agile organization, it's so much cheaper to convert an organization when that conversation is happening, mostly at the VP and CEO level. Because what happens is they start getting into it and they go, oh, what should I measure and all that stuff. And then they go, my department, I need to ship a project every 3 months or less, right? That sounds ludicrous to us down at the team level, but in fact, that's an amazing feat for many companies. And so the VP says, I got to ship in 3 months or less. And then they look at their dependency tree with 100 teams in the dependency tree, and you use some static analysis like I've done with big companies before, and you compute, oh, well, the minimum lead time for anything through this crazy dependency tree is 7 months. So I guess I got something to do. And now you have the org chart sitting in front of you, and you go, well, I can tune the sprint cycle time, but it can't be the fake sprint cycle time, because the fake sprint cycle time doesn't solve the problem. It just stays 7 months. But if you actually get their real ship dates down, then you actually improve that. And then if you restructure the organization so you have more feature teams and less component teams, you solve another set of problems, and you could actually squeeze that down and get that going. And now, but you have to have automated testing, because if you've got feature teams and you don't have automated testing, you got a big train wreck. And if you all these things just happen because the VP wants to deliver they want to be Agile themselves. And so I think the nuance here is top-down Agile is not the commander saying, hey, you guys be Agile. It's the commander saying, I need to embrace these principles for myself, for my entire department, and then we'll worry about you guys later. In a sense, it's them taking responsibility for their own stuff, which they often try to avoid.
and that I think was the, if I wasn't clear, this happens to me all the time, I'm not clear in what I'm saying. the idea that with a prescribed organizational change to a scaling framework, to me just feels like a bottom, even though, look, it's coming from the top, and the CEO said, yeah, we're into this big transformation, it really feels like a bottom up, because it really kind of just seems like business is normal. I told you to do something, now do it, rather than just like you said, focusing on culturally changing, what does it mean for us as leaders to change at the top, and how does that influence the organization as it goes through the system downstream?
Right, right. It's very interesting. Yeah.
So, Dan, you mentioned that some of these activities are perhaps in process with Scrum Inc. So I'm curious, what do you have going on there, and how is that work playing out?
Yeah, so I can't talk about it too much, but I can talk about it in general terms. As these patterns have started to gel, I realized that they can serve a purpose for assessment and diagnostics for an organization. About 5 years ago, we were talking about the Nokia test and, are your teams running a retrospective, and are your teams, what's their sprint length, and a lower sprint length is better, and all this other stuff that Bas Voda invented to deal with Nokia, which were all behavioral, and he's sort of disavowed them since then, but I actually think they had merit for the maturity of the organizations he was dealing with and the maturity of our understanding of Agile at the time. I think those kinds of metrics are interesting. I think that they became dysfunctional because people would realize how to game them and other stuff like that. Regardless, though, I think assessment is really good because it tells you what you could work on to improve. And as long as people are not punished in the organization for failing to achieve those things, but instead we use that as a diagnostic tool for coaching and mentoring and training and for focusing our attention, I think diagnostic tools are great. And so these five patterns create a structure for diagnostics, right? So when you go into an organization that has made an Agile transformation or wants to make more of an Agile transformation, what you can do is you can say, okay, so let's talk about metrics. And there are, a bunch of different types of metrics, value and cost we talked about, but there's also risk and elasticity metrics that are really important to Agile. And then you can ask pointed questions about what are you doing in these different areas. And then similarly with experimentation, you can start understanding how are people developing hypotheses? Are they actually going out to peers? Do they have, are they reading recent research to decide what to try in their organizations and other stuff like that? That tells us whether they're really sincere about the experimentation stuff. And then limiting work in process is really about cycle time, largely, in these larger organizations. And that cycle time can, in big organizations, you can analyze it using some of the static dependency stuff that I've done, or with Monte Carlo simulation like Troy McGinnis does, there's a bunch of interesting things there. But if you don't have any idea what your cycle time is, then I would say your maturity on the limit work and process thing is like a big zero. You don't even know, right? So what we're starting to do is we're going, okay, so let's take these tools and let's assess companies. And we have a company that has made a radical transformation to Agile. And it's really remarkable, and it's not a software company. With this transformation, we're going to actually run an assessment. We're going to talk about the remarkable results that they were able to obtain. And then we're going to talk about each of these patterns and how the things that they did fit into those patterns, and maybe even illustrate, where are some opportunities for further improvement for this organization. So I'm just very, very excited about being able to work on a project like that. And, of course, I work with Jeff Sutherland and think he's an awesome guy. So so that, too, is just a great pleasure for me. So you should expect, I'm guessing that if it really happens, which I think it will, its publication is going to be 6 months or so, maybe 8 months from now, and something reasonable.
Right. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, as soon as you publish, Perhaps you'll come back on and talk through it with us.
Yeah, that would be fun.
Good.
It would be fun.
So I think we're actually, Dan, I want to be respectful of your time and Zach too. We're coming up on our time box, or I think we've actually exceeded it. So perhaps we've not kept to our sprint promise.
We never.
But, I think that's okay.
We get together, right?
Agilists never keep to their own time boxes.
Did we just extend our time box to complete the work? Oh my God.
I think we did. I think we did.
Failure.
You should just tell the truth, Ryan.
All right. So really it's an hour and a half podcast.
There you go. That is
okay.
Like,
my bad.
Tell people. And I don't even know if people want to improve it, but you could ask them. And then we could prepare and we could stop complaining about the no estimates people at the front, and we can get a nice clean, talk.
There you go.
People like
and that. that's right. Well, Dan, at this point, we usually have our guest, any plugs, any promotions, anything that you have going on that you'd like to share, along with ways that people can get a hold of you if they want to continue the conversation. So blogs, email, Twitter, anything that you're willing to share in those regards would be much appreciated.
Okay, sure. So my site is senexrex.com, and there's a blog on that site that a lot of this work is published as it's produced. So this is becoming a body of work that may assemble itself into a book. It's not necessarily clear, but I'm really interested in feedback, so I hope people will visit it and provide some feedback. There is something that I can semi-advertise coming up. So HICS is the Hawaii International Conference on System Science. It's meeting in Kauai, Hawaii, in January, and I love that conference because it's filled with people from all sorts of fields, from information technology to lighting to electricity distribution to all sorts of stuff. And they're all about how do systems interact with each other. And so Jeff and I and John Tripp are co-chairs of the Agile track for that. We've done that for years now. And this year, we have a really exciting paper coming out by none of us, but a submission that I really like is one that analyzed pair programming in a meta-statistical way and determined that based on many papers, like 100 and some papers, that it does look like pair programming is more efficient, as well as much higher quality production rates are coming out of pair programming. So that was a really interesting result, and I was really happy about that because Capers-Jones sort of famously threw a bomb out at the pair programming people about 6 months ago, I think. Anyway, that's coming out. That's really great. And then, of course, anyone that wants to talk about large-scale agility at the executive level, please contact me, and I'd love to have a conversation about that. So I'm at dan@senexrex.com.
And also, I'll get a link to your Twitter handle out there as well.
Sure.
Zach, how about you? Anything going on? How can people get a hold of you? Anything to promote?
Well, you can just drop my, Twitter and all that stuff in the show notes. That's fine. For reading... I'm right there with you right now, Ryan, going through Graham Wallace's The Art of Thought.
Right.
It just makes me wonder about some of the things we discussed here tonight, how I might apply to Wallace's kind of framework of, again, the art of thought, and how some of these things could have evoked the patterns that, Dan, you've discovered and, those thought processes. So kind of thinking about that. I want to get in touch as well, hopefully, about maybe writing a couple articles again on SenexRex. I'd love to apply some of the base patterns that we discussed to some of my engagements. And just, I don't know if a case study or even just a white paper of real experience may help may be useful. Lastly, in November, I'll be attending the Southern California Agile Leadership Summit. Was invited to participate in that. So One call from the organizers came out to, you know, those attending saying, really think about the topics that are meaningful to the community to bring to engage in the discussion. So if anybody has various Agile related, you know, topics, whether it be from a small, you know, from the actual execution line of developing software to some of the executive applications of Agile that we discussed tonight, get in touch with me. Let me know so I can bring those, you know, to the summit and discuss them.
Very good. And I'm your host, Ryan Ripley. I'm at Ryan Ripley on Twitter, ryan@ryanripley.com by email. ryanripley.com is the website where you'll find this episode and past episodes, along with other writings and ramblings about many Agile topics. Please do reach out. Your feedback is important. We want to hear how you think we're doing on this podcast. So please do reach out. Let us know what topics you'd like to hear, anything good or bad about this or any past episode. If you're enjoying the show, we'd love for you to leave us a comment on iTunes. 5 is our favorite number, and 5 stars gets the word out about the podcast and helps us out quite a bit. And as always, we appreciate you being here. We love that you listen and can't thank you enough for your participation as the listener. Have a great night.
Thanks for listening to Agile for Humans. Let's keep the conversation going. Drop us a question on Twitter @AgileForHumans or visit agileforhumans.com.